Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and every major podcast provider. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player on our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or simply call into the show at area code 917-932-1068. Today I'm going to be speaking to Craig Miller from Defenders of Wildlife, and we're going to be talking about the Mexican gray wolf, which is the most endangered land mammal in North America. The Mexican gray wolf is considered the most endangered land mammal in North America. It once roamed throughout southeastern Arizona, southern New Mexico, western Texas, and northern Mexico, but throughout the 1900s, El Lobo, as it's called, was trapped, poisoned, and hunted to near extinction due to conflicts with livestock and aggressive predator control. From just 7 survivors, Mexican wolves are trying to make their way towards recovery. Its restoration is an opportunity to bring natural balance back to the wildlands of the Southwest. The Endangered Species Act helped prevent the extinction of the unique and ecologically important animal. Released back into the wild in 1998, Mexican wolves have been doing their part ever since, forming packs, killing elk, finding mates, and raising pups. But today, just 50 Mexican wolves now course the landscape in the American Southwest, fewer than half of what biologists had hoped for at the onset of the reintroduction. However, a strong anti-wolf interest in Congress and the states are aggressively working to eliminate the very protections necessary to ensure a future for these critically endangered wolves. On today's show, I'm going to be speaking to Craig Miller, who has been working very diligently and has just done so much to save these wolves. So I would like to introduce Craig back to the show. He was one, you may remember him from the interview that I did with Lords of Nature. So I would like to welcome back Craig to the show. Craig, good afternoon, and welcome back to The Organic View.
Oh, thanks, June. It's great to be here.
Now, Craig, can you talk about your work with Defenders and how you got involved with working with the Mexican gray wolf effort?
Sure. I'm the Southwest representative for Defenders of Wildlife based in Tucson, Arizona. And Defenders is a national nonprofit conservation organization dedicated to the protection of native wild animals and their natural habitats, and I've been working in the realm of wilderness conservation and nature conservation and environmental education pretty much all my life since I've been able to work. I've been working with Defenders specifically since 1992. Prior to that, I was a volunteer with a group called Preserve Arizona's Wolves. It's a citizen-based group working to educate the public and motivate decision makers to act on behalf of Mexican wolves and all that they represent ecologically to help get a reintroduction program off the ground. And fortunately, we've gained some traction with the help of Defenders of Wildlife and other conservation organizations and a growing base of public support, and we were able to get the decisions necessary to get wolves out of captivity and back into the wild. It's been a long, sometimes painful, I should say often painful, process. But the good news is, you know, today we have at least 50 individuals known in the wild. Back prior to reintroduction, as you mentioned, you know, the wolves were on the brink of extinction. Mexican wolves had been eradicated, completely eliminated from the historic range in the United States back in the early by the early 1970s. In the late 1970s, the last 5 known individuals, the last 5 Mexican wolves known to exist in the wild in Mexico were live captured and brought into a captive breeding program in the United States to help prevent them from disappearing entirely. And I have to tell you, at that time there was only one female remaining in the wild, and she unfortunately...
That is amazing. I mean, God forbid if she were unable to reproduce.
Exactly. You know, and fortunately, she had been sired by another male, which was not captured. It was not part of that captive breeding population. And there had been two other individual wolves that had been held in captivity for decades prior to that. So there are essentially three lineages supporting the captive population.
So, but isn't that kind of dangerous, though, Craig, that all of the current survivors are technically all related?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, there are three lineages, and it certainly is less than desirable to reduce a population of anything down to the point where you have, you know, just four founding wolves, four wolves remaining. You just can't get much closer to extinction than having one female remaining in the wild. However, through closely managed captive breeding and the certification and integration of these two other founding animals, the captive breeders, which includes private breeding facilities throughout the United States, particularly zoos and other breeding facilities, have closely managed the genetics to minimize any potential for inbreeding depression. The real problem is maintaining these animals in captivity for multiple generations could doom them to a life of captivity, which is why it was so important to reestablish population in the wild. And we're on the trajectory now to reestablish multiple populations in the wild to give these unique form of wildlife a chance at life in the wild.
Now, before we go any further, could you please explain how difficult it is, first and foremost, to capture these beings? Secondly, what it's like to just care for them while they're in captivity?
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunately the tool of choice through the last century, you know, for capturing four-leggeds, and particularly wolves, has been leg hold traps. And interestingly, you know, my organization, Defenders of Wildlife, years ago when we were formed back in 1947, back when, you know, predates the ideas of biodiversity conservation and modern conservation, but we were called Defenders of Fur Bearers, and in part because we helped start and really catapult a group called the Anti-Steel Jaw Trap League. So back in the day, you know, the very tool that was used to remove these last remaining Mexican wolves in the wild and protect them in captivity is the one that we were working hard to eradicate or rein in, you know, years ago. But in any case, these animals, there's a really interesting story behind this. I don't want to dwell on it, but I could say...
No, please do, because I know that our audience loves to learn about stories like this, because, to be quite frank, unless people speak to someone such as yourself, where else are you going to learn about this unless you actually take the tour, which I strongly recommend that people do that, and we can talk about that a little later. But unless you actually meet somebody who works directly with these beings, you're not going to have that knowledge or understanding. And just reading an article in a paper or even on a blog is not going to do it justice. So I know I personally would like to hear it.
Great. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. We definitely don't want to lose sight of the tour. This is a really unique opportunity for people to get into the wild in the Southwest, up in the high country where it's nice and cool in the winter, in the summertime, on Apache tribal lands, and potentially see one of the rarest animals in the world and learn more about the program hands-on, tracking and howling and surveying and participating in unique cultural activities too. We'll talk more about that. But what I wanted to mention is the fellow who captured these last remaining Mexican wolves is the same individual. His name was Roy McBride, kind of a famous trapper from Texas, who was responsible for killing many of the Mexican wolves for several decades prior to capturing this last handful. And that live capture was largely due to the passage of the Endangered Species Act, which is now, you know, nearly four decades old. The Endangered Species Act required that these animals be conserved and that a plan be developed to help repatriate them to the wild. And so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contracted this trapper, Roy McBride, to live capture the last remaining wolves. And I had the pleasure of meeting him years ago back in 1990, and I'll never forget looking into his eyes when he describes looking out into an audience of conservationists saying, you know, I never thought I'd live to see the day when a group of people really wanted to see wolves alive, let alone put back into the wild, because, of course, he and his peers had just spent previous decades, you know, eradicating wolves from the landscape to protect livestock, which is one of the reasons why wolves across North America have been facing extinction. Is primarily due to conflicts with livestock. And, you know, today, fortunately, we've been able to develop a much deeper appreciation, understanding and appreciation of the role that wolves and other top-level predators play in balancing nature. And we've also been very successful at developing ways of coexistence that help livestock producers and other landowners living in predator-occupied areas coexist, adopt management practices that reduce conflicts with livestock, and developing programs to help people not only live with wildlife, but to benefit from them, to help usher in greater acceptance for restoration of these key ecological actors.
I think most people just really do not understand. I know I personally was raised to fear wolves because wolves were enemies of the farm animals. And, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, you know, all the different folklore and all the little stories that, you know, the big bad wolf is going to come and eat you. And
right. The
thing is that society has been coming up with all sorts of stories about beings such as wolves. And the thing is that we've taken that, I think, a step further now that we're seeing animals such as pit bulls and the Bronx Zoo reported that a cobra was missing and people were making all sorts of jokes, but people were also in fear of a confrontation with this snake. And the thing is that there's so much misunderstanding out there. And as a society, also Hollywood has done its part to further play upon the fears of what people anticipate that, you know, an encounter with a being such as a wolf is going to be like. And, it doesn't matter where you go. There was somebody who made a comment on Facebook just joking around in regards to some posts that I put up there with the pictures of the wolves that you had so nicely provided, and was saying, oh, now the Arizona mothers can finally bring out their babies now that the wolves are gone. And, once again, a lot of misinformation that's out there. I'm not saying that wolves are not, they cannot be dangerous, but anything can be really dangerous if you think about it, but it's just the way that we teach our children. It's the way that we just think, and we don't have any respect really for any creature or being that we don't understand completely. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that has helped contribute to this crisis with the Mexican gray wolf.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of cultural baggage that has been saddled on the wolf, and unfairly, in my admittedly skewed opinion. But as you mentioned, you know, the myths and fairy tales from Little Red Riding Hood to the Three Little Pigs, all, you know, are deeply ingrained in our children and through our stories and fables and that sort of thing, to, you know, characterize wolves as these villainous, bloodthirsty, insatiable killers. And, you know, it actually reflects more human qualities than characteristics of wolves. You know, wolves primarily eat ungulates like white-tailed deer, mule deer, and elk. And depending on the environment, they also occasionally eat smaller mammals like javelinas or like a pig-like critter that lives here in the desert southwest, or
now,
rabbits.
It's interesting that you mention that, because I just read an article that up in Vermont, they are experiencing a huge problem with the deer population, and primarily because the average age of the hunters that dwell up there are in their mid-60s, because younger people do not want to go hunting. And they basically got rid of all the wolves, so now they're stuck with this bigger population. And people constantly forget that when you take one living creature out of the ecosystem, something else will take over. Whether it's something that's prey or predator, something will inevitably happen where there will be another being that will be dominant in that particular area. And that's, it just keeps repeating itself. I mean, people just don't learn.
Yeah, there's absolutely. You know, there are effects with every decision that we make, and the decision, whether it was based on science or good reasoning or not, but the decision to remove wolves from the landscape, to exterminate them, which was the policy of this nation not too long ago, has had catastrophic effects on not just the deer populations and elk populations, but the vegetation that supports them and other characteristics of those systems, like the watershed and water clarity and the effect on aquatic species, have all become impoverished in the absence of wolves. In the Southwest, we have a phenomenon. In fact, it's west-wide now, but it's a phenomenon called sudden aspen decline. It's quite sad, if you know what I mean. But they're correlated. Scientists studying this are observing or documenting a drastic reduction in aspen forests west-wide. And they've now correlated that with the time that wolves were eradicated from the landscape. And what they found is that because of the effect that wolves have had on grazing and browsing ungulates, elk and deer, removing wolves have caused those populations both to explode but also to change their grazing and browsing behaviors, so that they just lounge around the lush seedlings and saplings and riparian areas, and completely change the way that trees regenerate. In the arid Southwest, our wetlands, our riparian areas, are dependent on these streamside trees and vegetation to keep water temperatures down, which in turn support cool waters, support trout populations, et cetera, et cetera. And when you remove wolves, you change the system completely from, you know, not just the numbers of deer and elk and native prey, but you completely change the interactions between those species and the vegetation, and everything else in nature is related. So that was one major unintended consequence of removing wolves from the landscape. And fortunately, with that handful of wolves captured in Mexico, we've preserved the opportunity, the potential, to restore not only wolves, but all of those incredibly valuable relationships that they are responsible for. And we're beginning to document the return of those ecological dynamics to the landscape, which in turn supports the productivity of the land, which in turn supports human communities' ability to persist. It's all related.
Now, it's interesting. I've always wondered what would happen in a particular region where there are certain species that are really, the populations have dwindled down. What would happen if you remove the human element? You know? Well,
yeah,
the Discovery Channel has, I can't think of the name of the show, but it's something along the lines of, what would happen if, as I said, something along the lines of if there were no more humans or something or other. And it's something to really think about, because if you look at certain regions where there's an overabundance of particular species, It's basically because we did something to one particular species to enable another one to flourish. I mean,
yeah, no.
look at Florida. I was just talking to a friend yesterday who was saying that they have a tremendous issue in Florida with wild boars. Now, considering the fact that, you know, the wolf would, in essence, be a predator to the wild boar, it would be an interesting situation if they were to allow the wolves to propagate in Florida.
That would be interesting. certainly. You know, what the first thing that arose in my mind when you mentioned the landscape without humans is that even today, because we have assumed the role as the ultimate land manager, you know, even the decision to create areas or to allow areas to exist without human impact would be a management decision. It would ultimately be something that humans would decide, short of, you know, some apocalyptic scenario, you know, a post-collapse environment where humans just couldn't persist. That's pretty dark, and unfortunately we're sort of on that trajectory. But today, you know, such an environment would be the result of a management decision to exclude humans and human activity from the landscape, and I just don't see that as politically feasible, as desirable as it may be, you know, for some areas in restoring, you know, a high level of wildness and setting up a control to simply learn how nature plays out in an unmanaged or uncontrolled situation.
Oh, I agree. It would absolutely never happen. I mean, I listen to people that move up to the country. They move up to the country because they want the charmed life of the country, and then they complain because they can smell cow manure or, you know, other things that are very common for the country, and they complain about it. And, you know, if you wanted a Hallmark card, then you should have bought that, but that's the reality.
Right.
Or you get people that move to a park or where their home has a view of a park or a lake or something, and then they complain, oh, there's so many ducks and there's so many geese and blah, 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 and, you know, all the fecal matter from the birds that are, you know, just covering the driveway and whatnot. And I kind of look at them as though, okay, well, what were you expecting? A Norman Rockwell painting? I mean, this is what nature is about. And they're just completely removed.
Right.
Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking about the decision to create a management scenario like that. And it really testifies to how much influence humans have and how much we've assumed as land managers. And, for example, you know, we're in a position now where, you know, conservation biologists, population ecologists are predicting that within the next decade, within the next 10 years, you know, about the time my son graduates from high school, the only large mammals remaining on this earth will be those which humans have made the conscious decision to keep around. And that's a really important authority. It's a really important responsibility that we have assumed. Whether we realize that responsibility or not, we have assumed the responsibility to determine which forms of life will remain on this earth. And because of that serious responsibility, you know, it demands that we use the best facts, the best scientific information available. We need to the best of our ability, predict the consequences of our actions, because without it, you know, we will significantly diminish, you know, our quality of life and the ability of this earth to sustain us.
Now, I can understand a rancher's perspective or a farmer's perspective that the wolves come and then before you know it, some of your sheep are gone, you know, baby calves, goats, what have you. And that's a very, very big problem. So how do you teach coexistence? I mean, how is it even possible that wolves can coexist in an environment where you have these types of animals that are obviously being raised for human consumption.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Fortunately,
I mean, it's not like you can put out like with birds. I have bird feeders on my property. It's not like you could put out a wolf feeder and say, "Okay, here, Wolfie, you know, go eat." It's just not realistic. The wolves want to eat meat. They want to, you know, they smell the sheep, they smell the cows, and they want to eat. And you know, you can't blame them. Their nature.
But you can understand them, and we can manage our activities and manage our livestock in ways to reduce opportunities for predator livestock conflicts. And for example, building on that notion and this a collaborative solutions-oriented approach, we defenders set up a what we call Wolf Coexistence Partnership Program that it demonstrates ways that conservationists and ranchers can work together to protect livestock and save wolves and grizzly bears and jaguars by avoiding and minimizing conflicts. And it's actually very pragmatic, and it depends on many of the ideas offered up by land managers or ranchers who, you know, understand their part of the world probably better than most. And some of the examples of things that we've done have been using these non-lethal deterrents or what we call best management practices to reduce those conflicts. And that can involve providing range riders or cowboys extra sets of eyes and ears on the landscape in conflict-prone areas to protect livestock or to herd them together, which is a natural defense of predators, or to help move livestock as herds across the landscape to reduce vulnerability. Or to move them to areas away from, say, occupied den sites, that sort of thing. Providing guard dogs, which, contrary to what most people believe, you know, guard dogs aren't really there to fight off wolves and bears, even though some of the guard dogs can be big and burly, but their real purpose is to be there to help herd livestock and to alert herders of the presence of wolves so that the herdsmen or range riders can intervene in a way that doesn't hurt wolves and doesn't stress out the livestock and help move them to other areas. And some things that have been used have been cracker shells, shooting cracker shells from a gun just as a scare technique to get the wolves' attention and drive them away from livestock or to let them know that, you know, humans are nearby. And, you know, wolves are pretty smart. You think dogs are smart and they're trainable. You know, multiply that by 5 or 10. Wolves are really intelligent, you know, highly intelligent animals. And
no, I put, you know, I have more faith in animals than I do humans.
Well, you give them a chance. You give them the signals, and they learn how to coexist. Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. So.
Well,
but
it's interesting. One of the things that I've learned, especially about wildlife, is that with bears and raccoons specifically, if you teach a bear or a raccoon something, and I'm not saying, you know, you're going to sit it down in a classroom. Seriously, if you have an encounter with a bear or you do something so that, you know, the bear learns, like with an electric fence, if you have an electric fence, say, around your land and the bear touches it, the bear will not touch it again. The same thing with raccoons. They just need to learn once and that's it. Human beings, you know, they need to keep going back. You know, maybe the electric isn't on today. Let me just touch it. You know, people are just kind of ridiculous when it comes to things like that. But it's just interesting that with certain species, they learn the first time and do not want to go for a repeat of that lesson. And
yeah, they learn.
It's no surprise that wolves are the same way.
It is, and we use that very aspect of wolf behavior intelligence you're talking about is being used in the Mexican Wolf Program along with this tool we call fladry. It's a type of portable electric fencing that uses brightly colored flags strung across a rope or electrified wire. It's a kind of a passive scare device for wolves, and of course they'll get a little shock if they get too close to the herd, but it has been phenomenally successful at keeping wolves away from the largest sheep herd or bands of sheep in the Southwest. Up to 5,000 sheep once a year travel from a wolf-occupied area through our national forests And over the last 3 years, this sheep operation has been working with us on this Fladry project, and the wolves haven't caused a single sheep loss. And the rancher also reports that he, since using the Fladry, hasn't had any losses to bears or lions or coyotes either, and he doesn't have to get up in the morning and find his sheep. So it's been tremendously valuable. But the wolves have learned, you know, that this is something that, you know, they don't want to cross. And what's an interesting footnote about the Fladry is that this rope and flag technique is actually based on an old European style of hunting that was used to corral predators and shoot them, basically. And for whatever reason, wolves will not cross this line of flags dangling from a rope. Now, you know that eventually they'll test it and we'll figure out that it's not a threat, and some wolves may be able to get through there, but you know, that's why the turbo, the electric line has been added to it. But another thing that's really important here is that the ranchers who have been working with us on these coexistence projects are frustrated and upset by the high rates of illegal shooting, as counterintuitive as that may seem. But the high rates of illegal killing, lots of Mexican wolves, I think in the range of 35 or 37 Mexican wolves now, rarest land mammal in North America, have been shot illegally and as acts of sabotage to try to kill this program and eradicate wolves from the landscape once again. However,
why? I mean, if they know that it's an endangered species, is there any type of penalty that would be imposed if someone were caught doing that?
There is. There's both a stiff federal fine and potential jail sentence. However, you know, wolves in the Southwest, particularly, symbolize to many rural residents, you know, the oppressive federal government. You know, it's really an ideological, symbolic problem, more so than it is the direct impact of wolves. But some people see the wolf as the symbol of, you know, loss of control over decisions on how our forests are managed, and it symbolizes a changing way of life in a direction that some people don't want the land to change. You know, some folks still hold on to that, you know, manifest destiny, wild, wild west concept, and, you know, the rugged individualists, and even though, you know, received many of these landowners receive, you know, fairly substantial contributions from the federal government, despise the fact that the federal government is influencing land management decisions on our national forests. And, you know, so, you know, not everyone embraces the return of wolves. It's become a hugely controversial political issue in West.
But to eradicate an entire species, especially since these are beings that are part of our history, to just wipe something out entirely. I mean, it's interesting. We look at other countries such as China and their barbaric treatment of animals, and yet, you know, we're busy looking down our nose at countries like that, and then look at what we do here.
Right, right. Well, but it gets back to what you talked about earlier,
exactly.
And that is this deeply ingrained cultural attitudes towards wolves. And, you know, our society's perspective on wolves is shaped by generations of fables and myths and stories and Hollywood movies and direct experience passed on from people's grandparents about, you know, how wolves, you know, used to be so hard to live with. But I think it's important to step back based on, you know, how important wolves are to the landscape and the huge responsibility we've inherited or assumed of determining which species persist and which don't, and use science and look at what's really going on. And back in the day when strychnine 1080, which is a poison that was laced in practically every carcass across the West, they called it chain because it would kill so many animals in the food chain, was the predominant killer of wolves. But back when that was used on a daily basis in the West, it was a time when we brought tens of thousands of livestock into an arid environment, and we had huge mining and timber camps supporting large numbers of people who were also subsistence hunting the same prey items, the same prey species that wolves had depended on. So we, at the same time, we drastically reduced the native prey available to wolves, and we largely replaced them with much larger and slower moving cattle, which did untold ecological damage to the area, lowering its carrying capacity. And, of course, settlers didn't know how to do anything about the effects of overgrazing, and combined with, you know, prolonged drought, saw the wolf as about the only thing they had control over. And, you know, the cultural attitudes and the ecological conditions justified in their minds eradicating wolves from the landscape. So it's important to think about that, because what is necessary to accommodate wolves and grizzly bears and jaguars and other controversial carnivores back on the landscape to assume the important roles that we ultimately depend on is achieving a cultural shift, addressing those attitudes and perceptions of wolves. And I think a way to do that, the best way to do that, is through direct experience. And that's what these coexistence partnerships are all about. You know, talking with ranchers, building trust, putting their ideas into action about ways to reduce conflicts, and setting up programs to help people benefit from the wolves. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with this new program called Apache Wilderness Journeys. It's the first ever public tours offered by the White Mountain Apache Tribe in Arizona, which is responsible for, which owns 1.6 million acres in Arizona, the most beautiful part of the Southwest, ranging from, you know, 4,000 feet in elevation up to 11,000 feet, with spruce fir forests and aspen forests and more water than you can imagine when you think of the arid Southwest. This is the source of water for Arizona. Waterfalls. We've got one of the most beautiful waterfalls in the West on tribal lands that doesn't even have a trail to it. And in any case, these first ever tours will start this June, offered by the White Mountain Apache Tribe, called Apache Wilderness Journeys. And it's an incredible opportunity to support tribal leadership and this cultural shift that I'm talking about, and helping people benefit from the presence of wolves and other wildlife, and adopt management techniques to reduce conflicts, while also helping to promote a really unique Native American culture. You know, there will be elders telling stories about wolves and other wildlife and the role they've played in Apache culture. There will be traditional singers. There are Apache crown dancers who will visit the remote camp. The remote camp is out in a wolf-occupied area. The tours are led by the White Mountain Apache tribal biologists, so there will be early morning and evening expeditions to track and potentially see the rarest wolf in the world. Phenomenal opportunity, first ever, first tours coming up this June.
And how long is the tour?
The tours are 6 days. And the two dates are June 6th through the 10th, which still has a couple of openings, and June 19th through the 24th. I think there's one spot left on that trip. You can get more information at defenders.org/Apache Wolf. And I'm going to say that one more time, because I think it's a really important program, both to help wolves and to have a really good time, and to support the tribe in opening up tribal lands to help wolf restoration expand. Again, more information can be had at www.defenders.org/Apache Wolf, one word. And I think there are a few slots open for the June 5th through 10th tour. The cost is $1,500, and that includes all of your meals, permits on the reservation, guides, which I mentioned, the guides are the Apache wolf biologists for the tribe, entertainment, and access to tribal lands, which are otherwise off limits to non-tribal members up in a really beautiful part of the world. So
that sounds like the perfect birthday present. My birthday's in June.
Perfect. Well,
I don't know if I could broadcast live from there, but something to think
unfortunately
about.
The one of the added values of this particular area in the base camp is there is no cell phone reception, if you can imagine that.
Oh, world without cell phones, Computers and the internet. Oh, my.
Yeah, just campfires and wolves and crown dancers and storytellers. So.
Reminds me of Dances with Wolves, the movie.
Right.
That was such a great movie.
Yeah.
When he befriended the wolf, and then, you know, the white man comes along and shoots it, and it's just, you know, it's typical, and it was nice to see that Hollywood actually captured the human's capacity for just heartlessness and stupidity. It's just amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mention that. because you know, we've always had, our culture, our society has always had that attitude towards wolves. And even in our, the foremost thinking conservationists of the last century, I'm thinking specifically about a guy named Aldo Leopold. You know, he, at the time, back in the early 1900s, was one of the first forest rangers in the West. And he was out right, located just on the border of what's now the White Mountain Apache Reservation in east central Arizona, up in the high country. And back then, he talks about him and his buddies, when they were out doing, responsible for managing the forest, going out and shooting into a group of wolves, a pack of wolves, as they were fording the torrent. I'll just read you this real quick. We were eating lunch on a high rim rock at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the torrent, her breast awash in white water. When she climbed the bank toward us, shook her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming melee of wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves writhed and tumbled in the center of an open flat at that foot. Well, of course, doing the thing that they did in those times, not passing up a chance to kill the wolves. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. And eventually, they went down to watch the fierce green fire dying in the wolf's eyes. And of course, you know, then, you know, he didn't realize it until 20 years later, but in his essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, he claims, you know, I realized then and have known it ever since, there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. So in any case, the reason I mention that is because it represents, even from the perspective of one of our foremost conservation leaders, the pervasive attitude towards wolves that our society has held. And I mentioned it because of the very site of where Aldo Leopold's green fire epiphany occurred is just a few miles off the White Mountain Apache boundary. And we have located the very site where Mr. Leopold and his buddies shot into that pack of what was then Mexican wolves, the rarest land mammal in North America. And we will do a hike down to the Leopold site overlooking the Black River. In Arizona, and it's really a remarkable place, and it really is considered, you know, based on Leopold's experience, you know, the birthplace of modern conservation. Don't want to take up too much time on this, but one thing I've discovered is that the Apaches have a word called Chiné, which is the same word that's used for the term land and mind. Land in Apache is Chiné, mind is Chiné, and it implies a mind-land harmony, which I think is the same concept that Leopold was getting to in Thinking Like a Mountain, that only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of the wolf, to really know what the wolf is responsible for and the key ecological role that it plays. But what's really neat about these Apache wilderness journeys is that we get the Apache tribe is offering the opportunity to experience that, you know, experience this integrated lifestyle. It's very different than the compartmentalized lifestyle that most of us lead, and in one of the most beautiful areas in the West.
Now, Craig, I have a question from our audience. Jean Kelsey has a question she'd like to know. She's asking this from our chat room. I know I'm coming in halfway, but are there any of these wolves that are in captivity to help increase or repopulate? Are there still more wolves that are in captivity?
There are. In fact, there are about 200 wolves in captivity between the U.S. and Mexico. And they're held in private breeding facilities throughout both countries. There are about 40 breeding facilities. And those wolves are intensively managed to maximize the genetic diversity in the breeding stock. I hate to refer to it these majestic animals as just breeding stock, but as the source for wolves for potential repatriation to the wild. Now, some of the 50 wolves that I mentioned that have been documented in the wild today as a result of breeding and release are captive wolves that have been acclimated in what they call pre-release facilities, where they are their exposure to humans is minimized so that they don't become socialized to humans and tend to avoid them and maintain their natural aversion to human encounters. So those founding animals and their offspring in this captive population are essential to the long-term survival and recovery of Mexican wolves.
Now, we have another question. This is coming from Twitter. Ian would like to know, if you come into contact with a wolf, what should you do?
I highly recommend trying to take a photograph, but even more importantly, I highly recommend just enjoying it. You know, it's extremely rare for someone to have an encounter with a wild wolf, particularly a wild Mexican wolf. It's not a Yellowstone-type landscape where you can simply drive up a road in the Lamar Valley and pull over where you see a group of people with spotting scopes and see them, you know. But, you know, wolves don't pose a threat to humans like many people imagine. You're more likely to be hit by a meteorite or to win the state lottery than you are to be injured or killed by a wolf. It's extremely unlikely. Now, that said, you know, any wild animal, wolves, mountain lions, bears, javelinas, elk, deer, all pose, you know, some level of threat or potential injury to humans, but that really is more determined by, you know, human response, irresponsibility, or just a general awareness of their surroundings, you know. So, you know, really, if you're in a situation to see a wolf, enjoy it. Now, if you have a dog, that can create a little complication. If you have a dog with you, because wolves often don't differentiate between dogs and other wolves. And if you've come across, let's say, an active den site, or you've got an alpha male defending a territory where he has a breeding female, and your dog is there, and, you know, your dog's off leash, that can create a conflict. You do not want to get in between a fight between, and you just don't enter a dog fight, regardless of whether a wolf is involved or not. But, you know, if you're hiking in a wolf-occupied area, keep your dog on a leash, or don't bring your dog with you if you have that option. Other than that, you know, enjoy it. Wolves are really fascinating animals and really.
I mean, if you are hiking, though, say if you're out hiking, or I know there are certain parts of, and I'm just talking wolves in general, but I know that there are certain parts of upstate New York where there are a lot of wolves. I mean, what if you're just out and about and happens to be, you know, early evening and you're not quite back to your destination? They are nocturnal creatures, correct?
They're active all night, yes. And it's likely if you're in that situation, you would see wolf activity in the evening. However, you know, wolves are, my experience and the experience of most experts is that wolves are shy and generally tend to avoid contacts with humans. Like I said, if you've got a dog and you're in during breeding season or near a den, that's a recipe for conflict.
Yeah. But if you're walking around and say, I was told that, you know, if you're walking around in the country, always walk around with the stick just to, you know, a little bit of added extra protection, not quite the same as, you know, a weapon or some sort, of course, but the thing is that if you're walking by yourself and you happen to come across a pack of wolves, what should you do?
Yeah, I just, you know, that it just doesn't happen. Wolves are
so they're
much
gonna
more
smell
aware.
You, just like with deer, they're going to smell you, and
right.
You know, keep away.
Exactly. I mean, they understand that you are, a human is a much bigger threat to a wolf than a wolf is to a human. And,
yeah.
You know, if these wolves have survived, you know, they understand that it's in their best interest to avoid contacts with people. Now, I am aware of a situation where a wolf pounced on a hunter, and I believe this was from the Canadian border. I don't remember which province it was, but a wolf pounced on a hunter, and they had a face-to-face, and there was no injury sustained, but the wolf, once he realized it was a human, turned around and took off. And what was found out is that the hunter was covered in doe and heat scent, which is something that hunters often do to try to attract big bucks.
kind of served him right.
You know, encounters certainly are possible, but it's very, very rare and unlikely
anybody that walks around in that's soaked in deer excrements kind of serves them right, to each his own. Now, I have another question from Twitter. This is from Alex. Alex would like to know, are there any particular colors that wolves don't like? Some animals don't have a particular affinity for certain colors. Like, you know, bees don't like the color black. Is there anything with wolves the same case?
You know, that's a good question. For the Fladry, they're using a fluorescent orange, and we use a red flagging that's been quite effective. So fluorescent orange and red for whatever reason. Now, wolves have a limited ability to differentiate color, at least, and I don't know how much research. I know a little research has been done on that into the wolf's ability to see color. But the findings indicate that wolves may be partially colorblind, but they certainly are able to identify red. I can't tell you other colors on the spectrum, but I can tell you that the Fladry that's used is red and orange, and it has been quite effective at deterring them. So,
we have another question, and this is also coming from Jean Kelsey, who's in our chat room. She wrote, "We have a lot of coyotes, but some have called them wolves. What are the distinct visual differences? What are their characteristics that are similar?" And she wrote, "I.e., coyotes are not so afraid of people in this area."
Yeah, you know, coyotes are a little different. And they're very opportunistic, which is one of the reasons why they've been so successful at surviving. You know, they just have a tendency to just blend into the landscape and have adapted to urban environments. And, you know, much to the chagrin of pet owners, and I'm a pet owner myself, and, you know, there's nothing closer to my heart than my dog and formerly my cat, which we lost to a coyote. But I also respect the role of both cats and coyotes.
They'll eat cats.
You know, but they're different animals. And
I didn't think that they would eat cats.
Oh, coyotes, yeah, they'll clean up on cats. Actually,
they'll pretty much eat any smaller animal.
Correct. They are very opportunistic, and you know, if you're in a coyote occupied area and you have a cat, I'd encourage you, you know, not to let it run. Particularly in the late evenings and early mornings, and also, you know, if you have a cat and you let it run, you know, you probably don't want it declawed so that it has, you know, at least some kind of initial defense and
a better opportunity
to get up a tree. But
that's a whole other story about declawing. That's just ridiculous to begin with because it's their method of defense. But in regards to wolves, what if you do have animals, and I'm not talking about just cats and dogs, but say if you do have some chickens on your property, you know, not a whole huge farm, but just a couple of animals, and there's a wolf that gets into your barn. I mean, how wise is it to try to get them to, you know, get out of your barn or get out of the corral and, you know, leave your animals alone? Are they going? They're most likely, I would think, are going to fight you because that's basically their food and they're not going to give it up.
Yeah, the best approach there, and we're employing this on several private farms and ranches, is to if you've got a chicken coop, you know, make it predator proof, and you can do that through fencing or through the use of some derivative of this phladry that I was talking about earlier. We've also employed these things called rag boxes. RAG stands for radio-activated guard. It's basically a strobe and siren-type device, a scare device, a visual and audio scare device, that's triggered by the presence of wolves. Of course, wolves in our area have radio collars, or at least one in each pack, and so when they get within a quarter mile or so, the signal from the radio collar trips these strobe and siren devices, which scares the wolf off, and at the same time alerts the landowner to the presence of wolves so that he or she can come in and more closely monitor their livestock, whether it be chickens or geese or goats or sheep or cattle. It's been quite effective. And there are other techniques, but really, you know, fencing, a dog helps to alert the landowner to the presence of wolves. But the perfect tool doesn't exist. There isn't a perfect tool that applies equally well in every situation. It really depends on, you know, topography, the types of predators that are you're trying to discourage, and the type of livestock you've got as an attractant. But really, if you have a problem with that, you know, you can feel free to contact me, and I can help you find the experts in your area that would help assess your situation and figure out the most appropriate tools. I love doing that sort of thing. That's what most of my work involves. But the Federal Agency Wildlife Services, formerly Animal Damage Control, has a research unit that they're like MacGyvers of wildlife science, and they experiment with all kinds of interesting technology to do what we're talking about, just to minimize interactions between wolves and coyotes and mountain lions and bears and livestock.
Now, do you have any guides or information for people so that they can protect their livestock and poultry with, you know, just different directions and whatnot as far as when they are building chicken coops or how to implement these different types of equipment to protect their livestock?
Absolutely.
Is there anything available on Defender's website?
Yes. And Defender's website is defenders.org. And on the front page is a search. And if you just type in the word coexistence, one word, coexistence, you will be directed to our page. It's called Wolf Coexistence Partnership. Or if you just Google Wolf Coexistence Partnership, it'll take you to this site. And on here we have videos, and we have four or five publications. One of them is called Livestock and Wolves, A Guide to Non-Lethal Tools and Methods to Reduce Conflicts. And it's a PDF. You can download it. You can browse it online. Or if you contact me, I can send you a copy. And it identifies dozens of techniques that are being used successfully in predator-occupied areas to reduce conflicts. And then we have fact sheets that summarize some of these activities and other media to help get the word out. Also, if you have ideas about things that aren't being tried that you think might create a new tool, don't hesitate to share your ideas, because that's how virtually all these ideas or tools have been implemented or developed, is by people with creative ideas and us getting behind it and trying experimenting with it in the field. So just a quick Google search, Wolf Coexistence Partnership, or if you go to the Defender site, defenders.org, there's a little search on the front page, and just type in coexistence, and it'll take you to what you're looking for.
And Craig, how can people get in touch with you directly?
My email is cmiller@defenders.org.
And once again, for those of you that are tuning in, if you have a situation with wolves, please contact Craig, and he can at least point you in the right direction. And also check out the tour that's going on this coming June. And there are a couple of places still available or a couple of spots still open, but it sounds like an absolutely wonderful once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's just been wonderful speaking to you again.
Oh, June, thank you so much for having the show and for inviting me to be a part of it. I really appreciate all you do.
Once again, folks, check out Craig's the opportunity on defenders.org, and also get in touch with him if you're concerned about wolves in your area or if you want to do something to help the cause with the Mexican gray wolves. It's North America's largest land mammal. It would be a shame to see these beings just completely wiped out, but you know they're really working hard to do something about this. And thank you once again for tuning in. This has been June Sawyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon.